I'm Shelley Schlender for MeAndMyDiabetes.com. Today we'll talk with Justin Sonnenberg of Stanford University about his recent paper in the journal Cell. Sonnenberg does groundbreaking research using germ-free mice, where he implants them with various species of gut microbes to see what happens. He observes that when mice eat a typical chow, such as cracked corn, it feeds fibers to the microbes in the colon. They produce beneficial byproducts, such as vitamins and fatty acids, that in turn promote our health. Sonnenberg warns that the typical Western diet results in hungry microbes that don't make enough fatty acids, and if those beneficial microbes get hungry enough, he suspects that they can even start eating the gut. Justin also points out that he's a bench scientist who works with mice. He has not studied ketogenic diets in those mice. And he'd like more conversations with clinicians who treat people, including those who use ketogenic diets therapeutically. Here's Justin Sonnenberg.
This will be an interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
There's already a lot of conjecture about what counts as a healthy gut and what does not. And a lot of opinion already about what way people should eat to support a healthy gut and which ways are bad. Do you think that this is appropriate or is it somewhat premature?
Very good question. So my wife, who's a senior scientist in my lab, we run the lab together. We're writing a book right now for the general public to, one, try to demystify the science of the microbiota to some extent and make sure that when people are reading news articles, they have a good foundation of knowledge that they can launch from. Also, to talk about just kind of the practical aspects of what we're learning, because, I have two daughters, one who's 8 and one who's 6, and we realize that how we're raising them, how we're feeding them, how we're feeding ourselves has been greatly influenced by all of our work and other people's work in the gut microbiota. And so we thought, sharing that perspective with people was really important, with the idea that there's still a lot of caveats and it's still very preliminary. But I think if we wait to the point where there's been every single double-blind placebo-controlled study needed to actually make a claim, it's going to be decades down the road. I think it's not necessary to wait till that moment when all the arrows are pointing in the same direction.
Well, I can't help it. I have to ask, what is your family eating?
Primarily a plant-based diet. We're not completely vegetarian, but, many nights we sit down to dinner and realize that what we're eating is vegan. And we try to limit meat. We eat some fish. We eat some red meat. We eat some chicken, but mostly plants. And we eat a lot of whole grains, a lot of legumes, a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruit.
So that's just a background for what your family's doing. Part of this is based on some of your research. Let's go ahead and talk about who are you and what do you do?
My name is Justin Sonnenberg. I'm an assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Specifically, my lab focuses on understanding the gut microbiota. So this is the complex community of microbes that dwells within every person's distal digestive tract. And we have been studying this at Stanford for about the past 6 or so years.
When you say distal, you mean the stuff that's far away from your stomach, down the tube from your stomach.
Yeah, actually, that's right. We have bacteria everywhere on every surface of our body colonizing throughout our digestive tract. But the vast majority of microbes associated with our body are found in our colon, which is right, the distal part of the part furthest away from the stomach, the large intestine.
It's the very end of the line.
Right, exactly.
And it's different from a lot of the other parts of the digestive tract in that it doesn't have these feathery kind of microvilli that stick up to kind of absorb nutrients. It really is more like a garden hose.
Yeah, that's probably right. If you look at the architecture of it, it doesn't have, like you're saying, the feathery villi. And the reason for that is because, of course, the small intestine that does have those villi, it's trying to maximize absorptive potential to take up nutrients. And our distal gut, it appears, it doesn't play as big a role taking up a variety of nutrients. It takes up a lot of water, and it takes up a lot of these fermentation products of the bacteria, like short-chain fatty acids.
It produces some vitamins. It takes the stuff that's toxic and gets it ready to send it out too.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so it does all those things. Now, your research has been looking a lot at mice that do not have germs to start with, and then you add some germs.
Yeah, that's right. So the microbiota is a really complex microbial community. There are probably on the order of 1,000 bacterial species in each one of our colons. And then on top of that, there's a lot of bacterial viruses known as phage. There are some eukaryotes, things that are kind of parasite-like, but probably in Westerners, not real parasites. There are members of the archaea that live in our digestive tract. So this is a really complex ecosystem. And one way of studying it, which is probably one of the ways that is most broadly used and catches a lot of the headlines, is by surveying the community in its vast complexity, either sequencing all the genes of the microbes that are there, or trying to enumerate or catalog the species that are present in these complex samples. The other way of studying it is the way that we've spent a lot of time looking at the microbiota, which is starting off with a mouse that lives in a sterile environment, has no microbes associated with its body, no microorganisms. And then we add 1, 2, 3, 4 different species of bacteria to the digestive tract and look at how these species influence one another, how they influence the host. These germ-free mice also serve as a nice model host. If we want to study a human microbiota in detail, we can actually add that human microbiota to the mouse. And so we have a mouse harboring human microbes and can perform experiments to look at the complex microbiota.
And in that case, it's not just 1 or 2 or 3 species that you add in. You add in 1,000 species.
That's right. It would be adding in a stool sample and they would become colonized with, you know, around 1,000 species.
Now, I noticed that in many of the projects at the universities, the focus is on microbes, which do not include yeast, because yeast is a different family and there's a different way to study it than there is with most of the bacteria that gets studied, for instance. Are you all studying yeast in addition to bacteria?
We're not. You're right. Most of the emphasis for studying the microbiota in experimental models is on bacteria right now. There have been studies looking at yeast as a eukaryote, some yeast, some other eukaryotes, particularly in the context of immunocompromised host animals, mice, and looking at yeast that can cause infections. But you're right in that a lot of the diversity and complexity of the gut microbiota hasn't worked its way completely into experimental models for understanding. And part of that is just that we're, you know, at the very early stages of studying this. And so investigators naturally are focusing on the components that are, one, most abundant, and second, perhaps the easiest to work with or for which there's the most foundation of knowledge. That's bacteria.
You in particular have been interested in the mucus gel that's right next to the lining of the gut, as opposed to what's going down the center of the pipe. Is that a fair way to say part of the focus of your research?
The mucus gel is incredibly important in at least 2 respects. One is creating a barrier between the microbial community and host tissue so that we don't have microbes that are in close contact with our intestinal epithelium. And that's important because we don't want too much of an immune response, which we would get if the bacteria were too close. So this mucus makes a barrier, but it also feeds the microbes during times where their other food, which is dietary carbohydrates like dietary fiber or microbiota accessible carbohydrates, or MACs as we call them, are not abundant. So mucus plays both an exclusionary role, keeping the microbes bound to the lumen of the gut, the center of the gut, but also can help feed the microbes at times where they need sustenance.
Can you explain whether or not the current poo sample addresses the health of the mucus gel?
If we look at stool samples, we can get a good idea of the microbes that are residing in the colon. So there have been studies looking at this, and the stool sample reflects very nicely the composition of the microbiota in the colon. So we can have a good idea of who these microbes are. If we perform the right assays and the right measurements, we can actually know what these microbes are doing. So whether they're eating mucus or whether they're eating dietary carbohydrates. But there are methods under development, some in our lab, for getting a better idea from a stool sample what's happening to the barrier function of both mucus and the epithelium. And, you know, that's early days in those studies.
So being able to tell exactly what's happening with the microbes in the mucus gel, that's not as easy to do from a poo sample right now.
Exactly.
If we look at the kinds of problems that mean that we are end up starving the microbial self and ending up with microbes that don't help us, but instead attack the mucus gel and then the stuff underneath it, the lining. What would you say about the list I gave you of likely suspects?
Yeah, so, you know, I think all these things are in play. The ones that I think are foremost in people's minds right now are antibiotics, the lack of fiber. You know, a couple things that aren't on your list, I would say things like cesarean section, where you potentially jeopardize passage of microbiota, important microbiota from the mother to the infant, formula feeding and not nursing, because human milk has some important compounds that promote a healthy microbiota. You know, all of these other things you list here, I think, are candidates for negatively impacting the microbiota or negatively impacting host health through the microbiota. And in terms of ranking them, it's very preliminary to do.
So everything on the list I gave you, antibiotics, processed carbs that lack fiber, sugar, fat in general, inflammatory fats, inflammatory foods, parasites, protein, lack of vegetables, lack of fruit, all of those things you think could affect it.
Yeah, I think because these communities are so intimately tied to diet, I think if you get too extreme in any one of those areas, you will likely impact the microbiota in some way, and chances are there can be negative health consequences for that. So the inflammatory foods, there's good evidence that if the host is inflamed, this can negatively impact the microbiota. So a lot of times you don't see this in typical lists, but certainly increased inflammation can be caused by the microbiota and then can come back and also hurt the microbiota.
Do we need to eat grains and beans to get the kind of fiber you're seeing is beneficial to the microbes that you study?
We totally don't know what fibers are better than others, and if there are certain fibers that we should avoid. You know, for instance, kale and onions are, in terms of where our knowledge is at right now, just as good as grains and, you know, the fibers in grains and beans. It may be at the end of the day they turn out to be better. It may be that they turn out to be worse. We don't really know that right now. Certainly fiber from fruit is a good thing. What's clear is that we're eating way less fiber than we did on the ancient savanna, and this is likely not a good thing.
Is it mainly, do you think, that we don't eat enough resistant starches, or is it combined with all of the other lifestyle messes we get into? I think we've covered this somewhat, but just to be clear.
You know, a lot of people use the term resistant starch, and this is certainly a type of MAC, but it's a very specific type of MAC. And that the spectrum of microbiota accessible carbohydrates is much larger than that. Just so people keep in mind that there's really a huge diversity of these carbohydrates in food that have the potential to feed the microbiota. Indeed, most starches are not resistant and are, you know, high glycemic index and or high glycemic load and a problem. But in answer to your question, I think that it's a very complex problem. It's probably multifactorial in terms of modern plagues.
You were saying that the starch in a grain may not be as important to what ends up in the gut as the fiber from a grain.
Yeah, exactly. And the problems with our health probably extend well beyond lack of microbiota accessible carbohydrates. We're probably eating way too many refined carbs, foods with high glycemic loads. We're certainly not exercising enough. We have chronic stress. So there's a lot of problems that we have to deal with. But I think the lack of dietary fiber or microbiota accessible carbohydrates is something that should be on people's radar.
Now let's look at what you feed a mouse when you're studying a mouse to see how the microbes affect it. Can you just go through the list and describe each of these kinds of diets that I've listed here and say which one you're tending to feed to the mice?
You know, we have a spectrum. We have probably 15 or 20 different custom diets that we feed to the mice. They range from very high fiber or high MAC typical mouse chow that appears to maintain a lot of diversity in the gut microbiota, results in a lot of production of short chain fatty acids. We also use several types of high fat diet. This includes the Western style that's also high in simple sugars and simple starches. We have high protein diets. We have diets that have a single type of, you know, something like inulin as the only type of dietary fiber. So we've really studied many, many, many different types of diets and the impact on the microbiota.
Is there any diet here on the list that I gave you that you have not studied?
Let's see here. We haven't done a 70% protein. We've done up to, I think, 40% protein. We have a high fat mouse diet. We have something that's like that.
Have you done something that's so low in carbs that it's about 12% carbs, for instance?
We have not.
Have you done omega-6s versus omega-3s in the fat?
That extends beyond our scope.
How about the very high-fat ketogenic mouse chow?
We studied those in several different contexts. It's clear that this type of diet will definitely move the microbiota in terms of changing its composition. And I think more than the studies that we're working on or have worked on, there's a very beautiful study published in Nature, Devkota et al., that compared the impact of saturated fat versus polyunsaturated fat on the microbiota and showed very nicely that there was a bile salt dependent impact on the microbiota that actually made the mice consuming the saturated fat diet more prone to colitis in genetically predisposed hosts. So some connection potentially there between saturated fat and inflammation in the colon.
That's been in mouse studies, and I didn't quite hear, have you done a ketogenic mouse chow, the kind that's over 70% fat, under 10% carb, and actually not much protein at all?
Yeah, we haven't done this. We've been focused so much on understanding the dynamics of dietary fiber utilization, we just haven't extended into that realm yet.
Did you get a chance to look at Alberto Martin's recent paper in Cell?
Yeah, I know that work. Yeah, that's a very interesting paper. You know, it's first important to acknowledge that, as you just said, many of these studies that are being cited and written about are very preliminary. Most are very good studies, including this one. It will be years to make sure that the results published by one group when studying mice is, first of all, reproducible by other groups. That's always important. And number two, applies to in the case of humans. So I think before I start talking about this specifically, we must keep in mind not to overinterpret very early reports.
Can you give a quick summary of what you think the gist is of his paper?
They nicely show that butyrate in the colon, one of the products of fiber utilization.
That's a fatty acid. That's fat.
Exactly. Short chain fatty acid that I should say has been linked, and the authors acknowledge this in many other studies, to attenuating inflammation.
Meaning reducing inflammation.
Reducing, exactly. Yeah. That in this model, it appears to promote cell proliferation. And indeed, other groups have shown that as well.
And this is in mice that were bred to be prone to colon cancer, one of the more common kinds of colon cancer in people.
Exactly. Yeah. So these are genetically predisposed hosts. And so I think the big picture here is that biology is complex. The microbiota is complex. It's individual. Our genomes are complex and they're individual. And what may be true for one person or what may be true for most people, 90% or 99% of the people, may not be true for everyone. It's possible that certain subsets of individual that, for instance, are genetically susceptible to colorectal cancer or, you know, perhaps other diseases need to be cautious. But I think this speaks to the importance of personalized medicine, of understanding your genome, what you're predisposed to, and what you need to be wary of. I think there's abundant data indicating that short-chain fatty acids like butyrate have many beneficial effects, influencing both the immune system and metabolism, and that many of our modern plagues have inflammation or misregulation of the metabolism as a basis. I think the story is complex and it'll take a while to weed through all this.
If we have time, I'll go back and tell you one of the more interesting theories I had from someone about what may be going on with those Alberto Martin mice. But let's go on to the eating butter. And if somebody's in ketosis, the liver makes basically its own butyrate. Could this help out the intestine and keep it healthy and help out the gut microbes there?
You know, that's an interesting idea. I don't know that there's any data that speaks to that. And I'm not sure about the evidence that hydroxybutyrate can bind to the free fatty acid receptors or the GPR like 41 and 43 that so many people are showing are important in binding to short chain fatty acid. So interesting idea, but I'm not sure about that.
It hasn't been looked at enough to know.
If it has, I'm not aware of it.
How about just eating something that has butyrate in it? Doesn't butter have its name from butyrate?
One of the things that's really not clear right now is whether the site of butyrate absorption is important. There have been some studies that have shown that you can feed a short-chain fatty acid and that can mimic the effects of production in the colon. There have been other studies that have shown that you have to administer the short-chain fatty acid rectally or deliver it to the colon through some chemical means?
That's what Alberto Martin had to do because he couldn't overload
the digestive tract,
the colon.
So I'd say the jury is still out on that.
Okay, I'll get back to the interesting theory about that, but let's go through the list. So reports of high-fat ketogenic diets used therapeutically often focus on how many times in clinics people say that their digestive disorders, including irritable bowel syndrome or Crohn's disease, go into remission on a high-fat, low-carb diet. Have you heard that too?
I haven't. So this is one of the, and I'm trying to be better about this, but one of the real big problems with being a basic scientist is that you have almost no contact with the clinic and very little contact with clinicians. We're separated from that environment, but I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, that one's interesting. I think that Eric Westman at Duke University would be one of the people that could probably tell you a lot about that.
Okay.
He has pretty consistently, when I've talked with him, said that those are some of the first symptoms that people report changing when he puts them on a low-carb, high-fat diet.
Interesting.
Now, how about Lauren Cordain's concerns that many of the foods recommended as resistant starches or high in fiber have lectins and other irritants that don't always cook out of them and can be very irritating and be causing leaky gut all of their own?
First of all, I really like the spirit of the argument because thinking to our evolutionary past is a really important part of trying to make sense of the situation we're in now. A couple things we have to keep in mind. One is how rapidly are humans evolving and when were certain things introduced and how likely is it that we've adapted to certain things? For instance, you know, the ability to consume lactose by early tribes of humans that started drinking milk. Concerning the relationship of lectins to leaky gut, I'm not aware of any data. I'm aware of lectins. I studied them in graduate school. It's clear that lectins can be toxic in certain situations and whether they play any role in digestive disease. You know, if there are any data to that effect, I'd love to see them.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's the main part of my questions. Just really quickly, what else do you want to tell me?
I would love to hear your theory on the beta-hydroxybutyrate.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about the high-fat diets that are not high in protein. And they're high in fat, they're adequate in protein, but basically lower than most Americans eat, and somewhat low in carbs, definitely below 80 grams a day. One of the guys, Ron Rosedale, who's a clinician, told me that his guess is that gut cells are like any other cell. You want to feed them, but you don't want to feed them too much, because if you feed them too much, then it switches them from maintenance and repair into proliferation mode. Since they're one of the few tissues in the body that really loves to gobble up fatty acids, if they have a superabundant amount of fatty acids, then it could keep them switched over more towards dividing, which is more cancer territory, than into maintenance and repair. So he says that it may be enough to flip the balance for that kind of cell, and especially in an environment where the insulin levels are not kept low and other inflammatory markers are somewhat high.
Yeah, and this is something that's really bothered me, and we've talked a lot about in my lab is, you know, I mean, if you go to these traditional societies, it's clear that hunter-gatherers are eating somewhere upwards of 100 grams of dietary fiber per day. There are other studies of traditional agrarian groups that produce way more short-chain fatty acids than we do in their gut and are consuming more fiber. I think some people argue that the life expectancy is short enough to where things like colorectal cancer are, you know, difficult to gauge. And so I would like to get a better feel for how good the stats are for whether they are protected and don't exhibit the colorectal cancer rates that we exhibit, or if it's just not able to be ascertained because of lifespan.
But I'll bet you that their insulin levels are lower than most Americans and that their blood sugars are lower.
Exactly. So this is the other part that you hit on that I think is really important, is trying to recapture a diet in a very different environment now where it's nutrient rich and we're not struggling to find calories and going through periods where we don't have a lot of calories. And so it may be that we have to be very cautious, you know, moving back to a really, really high fiber diet. And that's something that we capture at the end of that Starving Our Microbial Selves. There's a line in there that says, are there going to be deleterious consequences of trying to recapture aspects of an ancient diet in such a different environmental context as the modern world? And I think that's something we need to be very aware of.
That is an interesting point that who knows? Thank you for your research.
Shelley, it was great talking to you.
Thanks, bye-bye. Take care. Justin Sonnenberg is a researcher at Stanford University. I'm Shelley Schlender. You can find more interviews like this at meandmydiabetes.com.